and brightest day, in blackest night, all other podcasts tremble in fright. Losers cower before the power. Orange is lust, and blues you can trust. Indigos feel, and white ones heal. Yellow scare, and green ones dare. That sapphire love and black hands glove will rock your foundation without hesitation. Chad and Mars face evil's might. Respect their power, for they'll make you see the light.
Hey, everyone. I'm Mark Marble.
And I'm Chad Bokelman.
And this is the Lantern Cast.
Episode 641.
We're back and we have another issue to discuss.
A fairly decent. I have problems with it.
Yeah, that's kind of, I think that's where our bar is these days, I think. The bar is, it might be pretty good, but there still are some things about it that don't make a lot of sense or questionable, but still, it's still, again, I still say this book is more enjoyable than the other book at the moment, so I'm not gonna kick somebody when they're down more than necessary. So we're going to the first topic of the night is Green Lantern Corps 15, All Fear or No Mercy. It's an interesting split cover with Guy and John. Not my favorite John look, but I know that's not your favorite John look either.
No, I prefer the variant for this issue, the one that's like a watercolor or whatever. I don't know if you've seen it. It's got all the entities on it, stuff like that.
That would be a better choice. I got to get my books. Yeah. My God. Okay, so we pick up in this this issue covers essentially two different stories. You can make a case the other one did too, but this really just covers the stuff on Korrigor and the stuff dealing with the Manhunters and the search for Prozolite. We pick up exactly where we left off, except now John is being controlled by Parallax, trying to instill fear into all the citizens of New Korrigor, at the same time also trying to use up the charge in his Green Lantern ring, which is another reason. There's another reason why Parallax would want that to happen too. Katma and Sora realize they have to try to do something here, even though Katma tries to resist because she's not the Katma that you know or you from your universe. But nonetheless, we get inside John's head and Parallax is basically taking John through his greatest hits of everything that he's ever been afraid of, every failure that he thinks he's ever had, being afraid of his father, the death of his sister, death of Katma Tui, including his relationship with his mother, which we will come to because that plays an important part in this. Because Shirley Stewart is John Stewart's guide in his part of the story. The AI is Shirley Stewart as the ring's charge keeps dropping ever lower, that she is guiding John through all of these images and all his failures, his past, because John can't overcome this seemingly on his own. We find out, not surprisingly, that one of the things that Sora had to deal with when Parallax was in her was that Sarko storyline, which was the son of her and Kyle, that was killed, and she didn't realize it was her own son until she was actually doing the autopsy on that. She had to relive that over and over again, I guess, with Parallax. Though I guess now she feels that this was kind of therapeutic in a weird way because now she's kind of numb to it. I suppose there's that. So the actual issue with the title is called Wounds, Morgan Hampton, writer, artist Fernando Pissarin and Eau Claire Albert. Arif Prianto, colorist, Dave Sharp, letterer, Pissarin, Albert, and Prianto were the cover artists. Variant cover artists were Jorge Fornes and Ryan Gonzalez. The Things to Come variant cover was Ariel Colon. Assistant editor Jillian Grant, editor Kathleen Wisniewski, and group editor Paul Kaminsky. We do see Sora pull out, which I'm assuming will be a factor next issue, but certainly not this issue. She still has a Sinestro Corps ring and a cool little box. The way her hands are drawn on this page, that's horrible. Looks like she's got flippers. This artwork is not maybe good for a few characters, but Katma and Sora ain't it. Now we switch over to the guy storyline where they're still paralyzed and being immobilized by the Manhunters who are siphoning off energy from Prozolite. And we get told in this issue, I guess there is an out to that new caveat they just created last issue. how the entities can recreate themselves when they die. Well, if you drain them down so fast while they're before they become fully mature, I guess you could stop that from happening until we get the next thing that comes across and contradicts that. But that seems to be what the fear is here. They're drawing in all the energy of a proselyte when he's young and he's immature and he hasn't grown up enough yet, so that could kill him. Aya comes to the rescue here. She uses her little green essence thing, whatever the hell they call it, her green doppelganger thing, and she takes over one of the Manhunters, because before Kyle helped wake her up and rescue her, she had been in touch with the Manhunters. She had understood their code. It's supposed to be primitive code, sure, so she can control it. So she ends up going into one of the Manhunters' bodies. She takes them over. She wipes out a whole bunch of Manhunters, Freeze Guy, Fatality, and Razor. Razor, of course, gets all ridiculously gushy and mushy all over the place. They start heading towards the source where Prozolite is being kept. New Corridor. We got, unfortunately, a Sin Sun entry point into the story. Not doing much, but Sin Sun in that... What is this? It's the son of Zod.
More Zod.
Yeah. Two characters, again, I don't give a shit about. But at least they're being consistent that they were on New Corrigar the last time we heard anyway. So here they are trying to help Sora. Meanwhile, like I said, we have the John seeing Katma's death. And Shirley's trying to give him the pep talk. It's like, hey, follow me. And they end up, of course, as one of John's big failures when he was in the Marines. And that's not big enough. So, of course, we know where we have to end up. We have to end up at Zanshi, because everything comes back to Zanshi every time with John Stewart. And no matter how many times he puts it to bed, he doesn't really put it to bed. But there's a little caveat. There's one other stop. It doesn't quite 100% end at Zanshi. Now we have to end at the grave of Shirley Stewart, where his inability to deal with what was going on with his mom's and make peace with it, and even to a certain extent pushing off the AI version that was inside his ring to reject that, as you know, because it really wasn't his mom. Well, he finally lets out all his emotions and he comes to grips with all this supposedly and apologizes and hugs his mom, because now we're at the point where the ring is about to completely lose power. And conveniently enough, if the ring completely loses power, when it reboots, it's probably going to go, it's in all likelihood, and we know can take it to the bank, at least short term, it will happen. It's going to reboot into its regular configuration, which will mean somehow, despite John Stewart's great magical enhanced powers, that Shirley Stewart is going to be erased from the AI of his ring again. And conveniently enough, when all that happens and his ring comes down to zero and all is seemingly lost, now John is able to muster enough will to get Parallax out of himself. And Sora is helping too with the ring, because Sora now is wielding the ring. But John is essentially able to, it seems, get the ring to get Parallax out to a large extent, if not exclusively on his own. They have Parallax contained at the moment. Back on Bayat, they're heading towards the core where more Manhunters are coming after them. And Aya, being the great intelligent AI that she is, kind of misjudges the situation horribly. And the point was, the Manhunters they were willing to let Aya get to the core and rescue Prozolite, because that what their real goal is they want to take over all the entities and use the entities to power, you know, all the entities to power all the Manhunters, and that's what their master plan is. So when they rescue Prozolite, meanwhile she's trapped, her energy twin is trapped in energy form, she can't go back to her real body, which of course the Manhunters have now taken over. And as the issue ends, if you ever wanted to see a really tight shot of Lorfleeze's ass, there you go. And that's the end of the issue.
Mm-hmm.
A very odd shot.
Yeah,
to say the least, besides the weird shaped head, as you accurately point out all the time. But oh my God, yeah,
he's caked up.
Oh God.
We
gotta put Corin's dead ass in there.
What happened to that thickness?
I guess the best place to start is the beginning. The thing that struck me wrong was the conversation, like initially was the conversation between Katma and Sora right off the bat, where she's like, you're right, Katma. And, you know, I'm not like you, you know, like, where are we running to, Sora Neck? And like all this stuff, like, okay, Sora would recognize Katma because, theoretically, in universe, most every Korugarian recognizes Katma.
Yep.
So that fully makes sense to me. Okay, John did tell Katma who Sora was last issue, when he was like, hey, this is a problem. But the fact that they would just jump into this weird look, I know that there's danger and stuff, so like, this is why I'm letting it slide, but just barely, because this whole I'm not a lantern, like, your universe is Katma, like, that we just let that slide, like, we're just gonna go full bore into this conversation and all this weird shit is just gonna make sense to each other, or is it, I don't know, it just bothers me. I get that there's bigger fish to fry at the moment, but it's just handled so nonchalantly. I don't know.
They gloss, you know, it's like, that's what, after a while, when it comes to storytelling, it's like the stuff that has to happen just because the plot makes it so gets kind of gets difficult. Just like when we have a requisite spot in this issue when Joe, the court historian, has to talk about the Manhunters and this and that and the history of the Manhunters. It's like, shut the fuck up. Honestly, it's like, if there's one person in this group who knows jack about the Manhunters, probably it's you. Razor might know a little bit less. Sinestro would be the one to be talking about the Manhunters. If anybody in that group is probably going to be talking about them. But you got to have Mary Sue Jo always jump in about her knowledge about something that she shouldn't really know about. Unless she has a whole lot of time on her hands to be spending time in the... Well, the Book of Oa was missing, so I guess for a while. So I don't know what she was actually studying, but...
Yeah. The other thing I was very surprised we came back to the whole Kyle Rayner Sora future son thing, and that being the reason for her sort of self-exile, as well as why she was such cunning bait to Parallax. But the problem with that is, at least for us, and I will include you in here if I'm not remembering incorrectly, it never made sense to us why this should bother her. It's, yes, it's their future son, but like, as we've experienced in God knows how many DC comic stories and Lanterns themselves have pretty much experienced, it's just a possible future. So it bothering her to the point of mental breakdown and her causing her relationship strain with Kyle and everything. Am I misremembering? We never bought that, really, did we? Like, yes, it should it bother her a little, but like, should it devastate her?
It's an interesting question, because it comes down to ultimately what is the bigger issue at the time. It seemed to be just a microcosm of the fact that, okay, she was giving Kyle another chance. And Kyle just, once again, doing Kyle things, just completely fumbled the ball. Doing the one thing you shouldn't do after the last time when you lied to Sora about something extremely important because it was convenient. Now you kind of sort of did the same thing. You just didn't tell Sora the truth when you could have, when it was fairly important to tell her the truth. Again, I guess he could be naive enough to think she was never going to find out during the autopsy, or she might not care enough to have the ring or whatever, do some genetic testing and... Or that, oh, by the way, I found something you might be fascinated by, Sora. That from the ring talking to her. I guess that could be traumatic because she didn't know it was a son. It's not the mere act of doing the autopsy, because if it was her son, maybe and something happened and they didn't know what the cause was, maybe she wouldn't trust anybody else to do the autopsy but herself. She probably wouldn't do that because you still have to cut your own child up. That, I guess, that's supposed to be the traumatic aspect related directly to Sarko, is the fact that she just all the stuff that she normally does, and we don't know normally how often she had to do autopsies, but things that she would do as a doctor perhaps without it having any, she would be numb to it and realize it's part of her job, takes on a different level when it's her own son. And the fact that she never had the chance to know it was her own son before, so she could have chosen not to do that. I don't remember. It's been so long ago now since this was Venditti in the core, that like halfway through that series too, that I don't remember how I felt at the time, how believable it was, how that would push her over the edge so much. I think I definitely was more along the lines of believing or going along with the idea that that would be it for her with Kyle.
Yeah. Yeah. The other, another thing that, that irritated me, was obviously Sinsen. But again, this is a, I let it go because Morgan Hampton's not the one responsible for doing this.
That is true.
He is picking up where the rest of the DC universe left off, with people just assuming that that Super Sons series ended. Was it Super Sons or I forget the name of it, but that series ended with the reveal, confirmation that Sinestro was indeed his father. That is not how it ended. But the next time we saw him in story, he kept calling him father. Sinestro didn't bother correcting him, so on and so forth. And now he's showing up to Sora saying, hey, sis. She says, what took you so long, Korg, meaning they have a relationship. Again, it is not this creative team's fault. They're just following what came before. So, but what came before was wrong. If you're going to give fucking Sinestro, one of the top villains of all time in the DCU, another kid, it merits more than just, we're just going to go ahead and call him his son now. I need to see the story. You fleshed out Sora. If he's really his son, give it the same respect. Don't just fucking jury rig the whole thing.
Yeah, I think they're just going to play fast and loose with this until they have a reason not to. That's what it is. Again, it kind of annoyed me that he showed up. But again, the last time we saw Sinestro coming to Korugor to try to get the remnants of the yellow battery, that it made sense that he was going to be there. So that didn't faze me that much in the big picture of all. I mean, again, of all the quote unquote problems with the issues, this issue, that one doesn't faze me all that much. I have more of an issue with Aya being so stupid. But then again, who knows? There may have been some subconscious plan, like a post-hypnotic suggestion almost in Aya to make her think that she wasn't that. Yeah, this was a good plan, and that the code was so easy and non-complicated, easy code that she could just go through and do what she needed to do, and it's like, yeah.
Yeah. The other thing, I hate that this is becoming a trope now, that every time somebody new gets a hold of Jon Stewart, they have to tell their own John Stewart finally letting go of Zanshi, John Stewart finally letting go of the murder of Cat Matui, letting go of whatever. They all have to put their own stamp on it. To the point where it's almost like I lost it somewhere. Maybe you can find it. But don't they pretty much say in story, like John says something about, I thought I had let this go or something. They self-reference the fact that we have been here before.
Yeah, and something along the lines, I think, of now that he's literally in the pieces of the planet, that somehow that walking through the pieces, I don't normally have to do that, basically, when he's thinking back on Zanshi, that physically being dragged through the rubble. And through
Oh, there it is. Sorry. Shirley says, I thought you forgave yourself for what happened on Zanshi. It's not every day I have to look at the floating pieces of its remains.
Yeah.
Yeah. It you self-acknowledge that we've had these personal revelations with John before, and yet decided to still tell the same story.
And they will again. not Morgan Hampton probably, but somebody. Yeah, it's just the only thing that gave me some satisfaction out of this story was at least John wasn't any more successful in dealing with Parallax during his initial infection than anybody else has been. Mm-hmm. That's the only consistent. I mean, you would think on some level he should be able to be more resistant to it.
I mean, technically, this issue is almost the same as the issue we got when Kyle was possessed, and that was when he was like having that conversation with his mom in that white space, right? Something like that.
And the paintings and all this stuff.
Yeah. So it's sort of like John's Kyle issue when Kyle was possessed.
Yeah, other than the fact that John somehow got out of it, even though it wasn't entirely all on his own here.
Yeah.
But it seemed like the final act was kind of, he was pushing Parallax out. So, but I guess that was a one thing, I guess, and not that you can make the case, well, it's not being original, so it maybe that shouldn't be rewarded, but it is for those who, I guess, who are, no pun intended, who are afraid that somehow, you know, Jon Stewart was just going to be able to shake even a weakened Parallax off, which, of course, we don't have an explanation for why Parallax is so weak either. That would be nice. All these little pieces. Maybe we're going to get some of that, depending on what they're going to do with Parallax. That would be nice to know. I mean, get an explanation of, like, where exactly was he? You know, where exactly was he for most of this time? Was he? Did we really think he was in Sora all this time? I don't think we're supposed to think he was in her all that long. But either way, how did he find her? Why is he so weak? Blah, 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 blah. I mean, besides the, kind of like the Freddy Krueger thing, where the Korgorians don't believe in me anymore, so I'm weak. It's like, Adam, give me a break. The Manhunter stuff was all right. I mean, it's kind of, on some levels, it's weird just bringing the Manhunters out of the blue. I mean, it's not, if we end up being tied back into Krona, because they're tied at the hip all the time, deep down. So I guess that would make sense. But at the moment, it just seems odd that they're out there. I'm going to guess it's related to Krona, since we know he had the entities to start with, and then all of a sudden that he didn't. So there has to be, I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt that there has to be some connective tissue here to what's going on. But the idea that the Manhunters are here trying to get all the entities to get powered up, and everybody's just, yeah, the Aya stuff is just, yeah, you know, yeah, I'm in control. And it's like, no, it's like, it's easy. And again, it's stupid, because they literally have her say, it's like they're making a path for me. It's like, that's when you probably should stop and think. It's like, okay, it's like, this is too easy. It's like, there's gotta be something going on here. But we don't get any of that, and it's just,
yeah, that's true. I wonder if she's impacted by wanting to prove herself to being a real lantern. I don't know. She's also caked up on one of these pages, by the way, when she's flying in and right before she possesses the first Manhunter.
Oh yeah, I guess.
Yeah, but regardless, yeah. No, the other thing I'll say is, more, this is another, like, this bothered me, but I'll let it go. Shirley Stewart herself, the reason for her sticking around for us to tell this particular story, I can buy that we kept her around a little bit because we knew we were going to end with the whole, you know, there are still two Johns out there, and the first one sacrificed itself, so the second one needs to have his closure with his mother, since he missed the death of his mother and the creation of Ellie and all of this stuff. So that, the fact that they made that weigh something and sort of mean something and sort of have a purpose, okay, at least they made that effort. I will also give them a bit of a pass, because at least with this particular plot thread, they took an entire issue, or I guess half of an issue, to actually deal with it on panel, as opposed to the conversation that we have been saying all along that Katma and John have been needing to have, having the last issue or the issue before, I forget which one, only taken a single page to have. So at least they gave it some space, at least they gave it a purpose I can buy. But also, it shouldn't have just been, it comes up in this issue and is resolved, quote unquote resolved, in the same issue it was finally brought up in. This is big emotional weight stuff. We should have been seeing hints of this sort of all along, more so than we already have. But at least it was dealt with a bit more artfully, I feel like.
Yeah, even though on one level it's another trope, because we know this goes back to, well, whenever anyone has a special ring, it seems like, well, you can start the clock, because you know it's going to be, because you know it's not going to last. Mm-hmm. Now, we might be okay with this, because I don't think either one of us thought this was a good idea, or it made a whole lot of sense to begin with. So I'm kind of surprised. I guess on one level, I was pleasantly surprised that they actually, regardless of whether they, I'm going to give Jeremy the benefit of the doubt to assume there was an end game to this, even though it's, would have been, the fact that they failed to acknowledge it even existed for like five or six issues after he came over into Jeremy's book is questionable. But the fact that they had an end game to the Shirley Stewart AI storyline, without it becoming, you know, some kind of, what's like what's happening with Aya and the Manhunters, I think that was good. I think that at least made it a little more understandable why they went down this road, if that was the original plan, or whether, and even if it wasn't, it's like the fact that they came up with something to resolve it and get it out of there, because it was kind of weird. It was kind of weird. I mean, it certainly was not the most special ring that they've screwed up. I mean, I'm so pissed that they got rid of Hal's ring that he made it a willpower for no real reason whatsoever, other than that was a thorn one. You could almost take it to the bank. That was a thorn one.
I'm still mad that they got rid of Joe's ring.
Joe is the next one on the list.
Because at least that was interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And it's really stupid to get rid of that, because here's a way to, quote unquote, make Joe special without having to make her a Mary Sue, because that was already part of her backstory from the time the character got created and we knew about her. The fact that she had a ring that did not rely on a power battery, that, yes, it would
take much. But it was recharged by her own willpower over time, right?
Over time, yeah. I wasn't 100% sure if it was her own willpower alone, or just the fact that the will. I guess it is, but I just assume the ring by itself was going to recharge. But I guess it makes sense, because like anything else, you need a power source to charge anything. So I guess it would be for her, you know, her brain waves, if nothing else, and her will. But yeah, it recharged slow, but at least that you had a ring that no matter what, you wouldn't need a power battery to recharge. So it was kind of like Kyle's ring, with as far as not having a 24-hour time limit, but yet having a natural source to recharge, which Kyle didn't to start with. So
yeah, I think too, though, that brings up my final point, which is John, both Johns are ascended beings, right?
Yep.
If Hal Jordan can make a ring with his own willpower, and there was a ring that self-charged, albeit slowly, over the singular or, you know, in the vicinity of an individual or individuals close to it, if it can be powered by people's nearby's own will, why can't an ascended being, even one currently corrupted by Parallax, funnel enough energy into his own ring to keep this AI around if it was that important to him?
Yeah, I agree. It was convenient. Convenient. So I think one way or the other, even if it wasn't the original end game, they realized that this probably was more trouble than it was worth keeping this around. Mm-hmm. So this was a way to get
a convenient out, but at least it was told halfway decently.
Yeah, at least it made more sense than, hey, everybody's ring stopped working, including Hal, so that means that his ring somehow is dead and can't be brought back as a ring made purely out of willpower, or Joe's ring can't just come back online and function again. It's like that was just weird. I don't know. Parallax looks like crap. That continues the pattern. Almost, I mean, he just looks like garbage. I'm glad at least we saw Parallax. At least we got a real Parallax sighting. That's cool. I do want to see what the plan is for what they're going to do with him. Because when you think about it, I hope the plan is that, well, let's throw him inside a power battery, even if it's the yellow one. Let's throw him inside a power battery, because what's inside all the power batteries? The Starbreakers.
Yeah.
If they even remember that in their own story anymore. But that would kind of not being able to throw stuff in there as a prison and just keeping other things in there might not work the same anymore, or might be a little more dangerous depending on what else you're throwing in there. So I'll be curious what they're going to do with that. I bet they're probably dealing with the Sora stuff, just because, you know, Kyle and Sora are going to end up crossing paths again. Once Kyle gets sprung from his temporary duty on Earth, Sora and
And probably has some sort of love arc with Odyssey for some godforsaken reason.
Potentially. It's potentially that way. I'm not 100% sure. I mean, you assume they're going to go that way because, you know, it is Kyle. Yeah. Any port in the storm. He makes Hal look good these days, as we joked about earlier today. It's actually Kyle that you have to worry about more. Like, if you had a girlfriend, you'd be more worried about Kyle around your girlfriend these days more than Hal, since Hal really hasn't been going from port to port much lately. Actually, even in the John's run, because pretty much other than Cowgirl, it's only been really Carol. And I know we had some hints and flashbacks and other relationships that Hal, I guess, supposedly had during the Morrison run, including that alien nurse or whatever it was. It's probably all building up to Sora. Sora and Sinestro and Sora and Kyle and having the having that kind of reunion and seeing But I mean, it's good to have Sora back. I mean, she's not drawn particularly well. And not just even on that splash page that I'm talking about with the ring coming out of the case. I mean, when it literally looks like she has flippers for hands. But she's... Yeah, the artwork in this one is a lot more shaky for me. There's not much that I really like in this one. Even Shirley Stewart kind of almost looks like, honestly, she kind of looks like a man in drag half the time.
The last thing I'll say is they finally addressed the Katmajohn conversation. They did it in one page, but they did it. The lingering plot thread of Shirley being the AI, they finally dealt with it, albeit in about half of an issue. The next plot thread that they need to address is Razor and Aya, who is all over this issue a weird amount. Razor and Aya. How much do you want to bet next issue we're going to focus and deal with that in a singular issue?
I'm not as sold on that one, just because you would think that would be something that Jeremy would want to handle. It would seem very weird on some basic level. That the only reason we have these characters in this book, really, is because Jeremy's writing the book and Jeremy wrote the animated show. So to bring these characters back, it is weird by default that he's not writing, that they're not in his book to begin with. But it's also weird. But it's also weird that if they're going to delve deeper into the relationship and try to flesh it out, that he's not going to be the one doing it. Now, that doesn't mean he can't give Morgan Hampton plot points, or he may not be actually writing the script, but he might give him bullet points that I'd kind of like you to do this if you can in your book, because I don't have time to do it in mine right now because of the stories that I'm covering. That's possible too, but you could be right. I don't know. It's just,
I mean, just why else make the point of the my love coming to the rescue again and guy, all right, we don't have time for hugs and kisses, and then drawing as Aya keeps talking in her Manhunter body, the making sure we draw Razor with a stupid shit eating grin on his face the entire time, and then, you know, and then when he's flying up to him. That's three times I've saved you if you're counting. We're just doing this a little too on the nose. So it's out of nowhere. We haven't really been focusing on these two at all, and now all of a sudden you're going to start giving it to us. Well, guess what? The last time they gave us a hint of something, it was a hint of why did they make Shirley Stewart's ring chime in with a damn in the middle of that conversation between John and Katma. It was just to remind us, oh, yep, don't forget, she's still here. We're going to deal with that. And guess what? One of the very next issues, we did that. I guarantee they're doing the same thing with Razor and Aya here. Remind you, here, these two are in love. They've been reconnected and reunited. Don't forget that. Because they're going to tell us in this next issue or the one after, they're going to get to it.
You'll probably be right. It would be now what they give us, that remains to be seen how satisfying that'll be.
Yes.
But
agreed. All right, what's next?
So, let's do sales. Let's do sales.
What's the website you go to for that, the commentary?
Comic Book Revolution, I believe. Okay. I think that's what it is.
No, I'm just pulling it up on my end.
Oh, I can give you the link if you want. Just give me a second.
No, I got it. You're good.
So Absolute Green Lantern number 11, which we don't really care about at all. That's number 25. So again, Absolute Green Lantern has not weakened from the perspective that it's not falling month after month after month, but it definitely now has settled into a book that used to be within the top 20. and I believe the last 2 months has been like around 25. So it's off. So it's weakened a little bit. But for an absolute book, it's weak. But any other Green Lantern book would kill to be selling as well as this book, which is still mind boggling. That tells you that preaches to the rising tide raises all lifts all ships concept. That because the absolute line is so popular, even something like this book, which cannot possibly be anywhere near as good as some of the others, it just gets to waft in the pleasant smell around it. So the books we do care about, Green Lantern number 32 fell from 125 to 136. Now, the reason why that's important, and I was thinking about this after the fact, is realistically speaking, Green Lantern 32 should have sold better than the month before, because based on the hype, that was the issue that we thought Hal was going to propose to Carol. So that would have, and we thought that would have a direct lead into issue 600, ha ha ha, number 33. But yet the fact that Green Lantern 32 fell 11 spots, that's not a good sign.
No.
Green Lantern Corps 13 fell from 125 to 138. Actually, that's got to be a mistake. They must have made a typo on that, because they both couldn't be 125. I just realized that now. Maybe when you're talking, I can go back and look at last month's, and I can find out which one was actually 125. But they both can't be 120. They both can't be 125. Makes me now want to double check their numbers overall. But nonetheless, both Green Lantern books were in the 130s. That doesn't bode well. But the Green Lantern is the only one that's really interesting is Green Lantern, because we naturally assume that Green Lantern 33. is going to get a big boost in sales because it's being hyped, even if it's artificially, in a Barbenheimer kind of way, because it's issue 600. Now the question
is multiple variants.
The multiple variants that some people like you tend to really like.
To be fair, I only liked one of those extra variants.
Did you only buy one?
Yeah, I only got the regular copy because, first of all, the regular cover is a double page spread. There's more on the back.
Okay, yes.
So that's cool looking. And I got the other one just because it's just basically a Green Lantern Where's Waldo.
Okay. So, all right.
Yeah.
But the point is, with all that, we anticipate this book is going to have a dramatic increase. Now, the question, however, is, how much is that dramatic increase going to be? Because the bar has kind of been raised by that horrible DCKO with Omega Bam Man.
Yeah, slam. That's true.
The bar has been raised because another piece of evidence to support the rising tides lifts all boat theory is the fact that issue, which was not particularly special on any level, yet it sold number 30. So that kind of raises the bar, because you'd like to think Green Lantern 600 would be able to beat the KO special and do better than number 30. But
that's,
it might.
That's true.
But it might not. But the only like I said to you, kind of.
At the very least, get close, though. Like, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because,
I mean, it's got.
Because if the event boost is a hard boost to overcome, even with an anniversary issue. So if it doesn't beat it, I wouldn't be surprised, but it better not trail by like 15 or more. You know what I mean?
Well, I think the bare minimum that would be acceptable would be in number 50. It better be inside the top 50. If for some reason it's not, then that tells you all you need to know about where Green Lantern is. Now, as I said to Chad earlier, the only glass half full aspect, if it's more like around 50 to 75 as opposed to being like 25, is that that would just make the inevitable massive drop for Green Lantern 34 a lot less. Oh my god, if you're only dropping from like 50 to like out of the top 100 as opposed to being like number 15 and dropping out of the top 100 the next month. But let's see, obviously the books are not trending downward, are not trending upward, and they're trending in the wrong direction. But the thing about number 32, I thought about that after I gave you the numbers, and I thought about it. It's like, wow, that's really crappy, because we really thought falsely led to believe that Hal was going to propose to Carol, and that was going to have a dramatic impact on the status quo of Green Lantern potentially, and leading into the events of Green Lantern 600, when it actually had none of that was true. But we didn't know that at the time. That might explain why the book didn't gain sales from the month before, but you would think that it wouldn't have a dramatic drop off, because you would think the people that were buying it the month before would still be buying it, especially because of the hype, but apparently not. So we'll see. Green Lantern 33 obviously will be quite interesting to see where that falls in the charts. once we get the next batch of sales numbers, but that's pretty much it.
Yeah, like I said, yeah, I'm definitely curious about the numbers for 600, but I'm more curious about the numbers for 34 and 35 in the wake of 600 and see how drastic that drop is, if any. We kind of assume there will be one of some kind. It's just a matter of how much, but I guess you got to allow for the possibility that it could just get better. You never know. Obviously, you and I have our opinions and so on and so forth, but it doesn't necessarily mean the entire Green Lantern community shares them. So maybe Kyle becoming the lead is enough to keep it relatively elevated for a while. Who knows? We'll see.
Green Lantern Corps number 12 was 114. So it actually was a worse drop when you think about it, because he said he had both books what ranked at 125, dropping into the 130s. Green Lantern Corps 12 was actually 114. So if it really dropped 114 to about 138, was that what I said?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Let me check my... Yeah, Green Lantern Corps 13, according to them, dropped to number 138. So that would mean... But they said... Yeah, so that would mean that it went from 114 with issue 12 to 138 with issue 13. So that's a bigger drop, and more noticeable only because Core had sold better that month than Green Lantern had. But yeah, so that's it. I mean, objectively speaking, there's no way that whatever Green Lantern 33 sells that, there's no way the next issue is going to sell better. It's like let's not say no way. It's almost impossible. It's because we know it's like once in a great while. And I think that happened with one of the Absolute books, actually. Might have been Green Lantern. That the second issue actually sold better than the first. But we know, historically speaking, it's almost take it to the bank that issue two is always going to have a significant drop off from issue one. Even if issue one's a huge hit, it's going to have a big drop off.
Yeah.
And plus, we both know issue 33 could have been a lot worse, but I still don't think, as a jumping on point, that may not. I don't think I find it difficult to believe it's going to bring more people on than it might lose. But I also think the story that we think we're getting based on the solicits doesn't seem interesting enough that it's going to have a massive improvement in sales. Could something happen? Sure, it could. But let's see what 33 sells like, and 34 will be a nice little litmus test to see. If 33 is in the top 50 and 34 somehow stays inside the top 80, then maybe there's a chance. Not necessarily, because some people could have stuck around for an issue and then they'll jump off right after. It's like, well, I gave it a shot for an issue, but let's see what 33 does first. And then at least that might, that can either raise the bar a little bit too, but it also might give you some hope, depending how things play out.
Yep. All right. What's next?
My High Evolutionary pop shipped and arrived.
I saw that one took a while, huh? Or did it take a while like that last time for Kyle?
I don't necessarily think it took longer. I just remember
seeing posts about people getting like their Mockingbird and shit and being like, well, that was a while ago.
I don't think I'm trying to remember when I had to redeem that. I think I only redeemed it in January. And I don't remember. I would have to go back. I don't know if I have the shipping notifications to go back and see like when from the time we redeemed our tokens for Parallax and all those, how many more months after that before it shipped. I'm not entirely sure. I mean, my natural instinct is to say you're probably right, that I thought it took a little bit longer from the time, even though they did say it was supposed to ship sometime first quarter. And I think ours were first quarter, too. I think that's their pattern, at least. I mean, it has to be different patterns if they do different NFT drops during the course of the year. But I thought our Parallax ones were first quarter, too. If not, they had to be second quarter. I know it was the beginning of the year when they arrived. Not when they came out, when they were available, but when they arrived. But, yeah, it showed up in Easter. Sure, the High Evolutionary would have something to say about that one way or another. But it was... It's cool. I'm glad I got it. That's the only thing of toy news that's interesting, though. I did just see Donnie post his review on that Beast Kingdom figure, which at least
raised it. I saw that. I saw he got his. And speaking of figures and shipping notifications, my White Lantern Batman, I checked it earlier today. It said it was in Dallas, so I should have that by tomorrow. So that's already shipped from GameStop.
Yeah, I know. So I saw somebody post. I saw somebody post that they received their White Lantern Batman 2. So that was pretty cool. Now let's see, going through the list. Let's go through what I've seen. It's been a while since we've done this, especially with the skip week. I saw, in order, if this is correct, I saw Forbidden Fruits, They Will Kill You, The Drama. Those are the movies that I've seen. The Drama was the most interesting of the three. That's the Robert Pattinson Zendaya movie, which features, one must point out, which features arguably, I would say inarguably, if you're making right now, if I had to make a list at the top 10, either most absolute worthless or annoying characters to ever be on film. The character of Rachel in that movie, who is the best friend of Robert Pattinson's wife. Oh my God. She is the most unlikable character you're probably ever going to see. Not redeemable in any way. And the fact is, I'm not going to go into spoilers about what the big event here, what the drama is that's going on about Robin Pattinson and Zendaya as they're getting close to getting married. The drama that kind of throws a monkey wrench into everything. But even if Zendaya actually had, her character had done what she had contemplated doing, and I'll just say, leave it at that, because there have been people giving away talking about the worst things that they've ever done. Even if she had actually had done what she had contemplated doing, she still would have been more redeemable than the Rachel character, who is just a complete piece of garbage and so many levels. It's one of those characters that you just want to punch in the face. At least in a horror movie, you can get away with it because you know the only reason they're doing that is so when this character dies, people will go, yes. Because people are waiting for this character to die in a painful way because they are completely irredeemable. Not so much in this case. The drama is interesting. I would personally just wait for it to be on HBO Max, though, because it will be. I believe it's an A24 movie, so it should only be a matter of time. Forbidden Fruits was interesting. I'm trying to remember what the best analogy was. It's kind of like The Craft. What the hell did it? Somebody had a good analogy. It was The Craft meets something else. But because it does deal with like a coven of witches and things like that. I thought that was enjoyable. I think it was a little slow though. I struggled to stay awake in that one. They Will Kill You, I enjoyed. The violent parts are really, really over the top. So that's good. I think it kind of lost me a little bit. And the ending is interesting, but I mean, you probably saw most of it coming, but I didn't spend too much time thinking ahead as I was watching that movie. So I just kind of let it all fall into place. But I would probably say I enjoyed Forbidden Fruits a little bit more, though, than They Will Kill You. I also saw the first two episodes of Shadow Lord, the Darth Maul animated show.
I heard that was good.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it. I think the setup so far is really good. Again, based from a pure action perspective, it is a little slow, too. Not slow enough where it bothers you, because the episodes, I think, are only 30 minutes, so they can't be too slow. If it's going to drag, it's not going to drag too long. But they're setting stuff up in it, so there's enough action and there's enough interesting plot points that are being thrown out there in the characters that they're layering in that I enjoyed it. I think it's going to work very well. I hopefully this will be a show that has multiple seasons, which would make sense because obviously the character has time to go from where he was in Rebels because this takes place, I think, really shortly after Revenge of the Sith. So there's a decent chunk of time for Darth Maul to do Darth Maul things. But yeah, I was really looking forward to that. So I'm glad that's on. And
I actually finally watched something I've been meaning to watch for a while because I saw it was free on Fandango at Home, you know, AKA Vudu, used to be Vudu, is what I have all my stuff digitally stored on my digital library, and I buy stuff occasionally there. I've been curious about that movie, The Man from Earth, from 2007. You ever see that one?
No.
It's about a guy who's retiring or actually moving away. He's a professor, and his friends come to say goodbye to him, and they're all hanging out in a cabin as he's packing, and he's telling him the story of his life, and it turns out he's revealing a story that he's actually an immortal, and that he was actually, you know, the man that history considers Christ, and so on and so forth. And they're like trying to, because they're all a bunch of professors, they're trying to poke holes in his theories and his story and so on and so forth. You know, much in the same way, is it My Dinner with Andre that it just all takes place at a dinner table at a restaurant?
I think that is correct.
Yeah, The Man from Earth all takes place just kind of in this one living room as this guy's telling the story. Is it the best movie I've ever seen? No, but it's such an interesting story and it's so well done that, especially for a movie that, you know, it's an hour and a half and almost an hour and a half, and it takes place in the entirety of one setting, essentially, in or outside this cabin, is pretty interesting because we don't even get like flashbacks. Like if he's telling the story of, you know, his time as an early caveman or whatever, you know, we don't flash back to those moments. So we don't even get flashback scenes. So it just all takes place in this house, this cabin or outside of it. And yet it's still entertaining for that whole bit. IMDb has it at 7.8 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes has it at 100%. It's just, I've been wanting to see it for a while. It's got David Lee Smith, John Billingsley, William Catt, Ellen Crawford, Annika Peterson, and Tony Dodd. I only recognize Tony Dodd's name.
Todd,
sorry. But yeah, I had been meaning to watch it for a while and it was cheap and free and I watched it and I was like, actually, this is not bad. You know, if it's going to take place in a single setting, you expect to be bored out of your gourd, but this is pretty fun. I heard there was a sequel to it. I looked that up online, but I heard that was really shit.
Yeah, that does happen. That does happen more times than we probably would like to admit.
All right. What else did you have?
I think. Oh, one other thing. I knew there was one other thing. And it's too bad we didn't talk about it last time, only because we would have been ahead of the curve as opposed to looking like I'm being reactive and reactionary. The idea that the stories that have been circulating, which I kind of, because I had thought about this. I thought about this a few weeks ago, that we may never get Doomsday to begin with because of the fact that Marvel may very well move Avengers Doomsday up, which when you really think about it, makes perfect sense because, first of all, it makes sense Dune isn't going to move. It's been a safe bet for a while that despite the conventional logic, that Dune won't move because Dune, that was originally Dune's day, no pun intended, to begin with, because they claim that day, that was always the original release date for Dune. And they have all the IMAX and premium screens locked up. It's only been a release date for the Avengers since they moved it out of the May release that we should have gotten to push it back 7 months. So it would make sense that Marvel would be less married to that day, that Disney would be less married to that day. Plus, I believe I think it might just be 1 week earlier, the premium screens, the IMAX screens are not committed to anything. So all they have to do is move up 1 week and they get breathing room and they're going to get all the additional money from the IMAX screens. So it would kind of be stupid not to move. And it's another reason why Dune wouldn't move is because Dune was never going to set an opening weekend record or aim for it or be compared to an opening weekend record. You have the large shadow of Endgame hovering over Doomsday. So if for some reason Doomsday opened up well, but only did like a $210 million opening or a $220 million opening, but didn't even sniff Infinity War, No Way Home, or, you know, in the same area code as Endgame, that's going to make Marvel look even worse. Regardless of the fact that there's direct competition, and you know that, the fact is, well, if Marvel was still Marvel, Marvel would have blown anything out of the water. So I would not surprise me at all that they're going to move. Plus, you look at the history of Infinity War and Endgame. Both those movies were supposed to come out in the beginning of May, and they both came out in April. Yeah. There's a track record there, and I believe, if I remember correctly, Infinity War did move until we were already in March. That's why I was shocked when they actually said it, because I wasn't even sure how they were going to pull that off with all the theaters and their bookings and everything else. That was easier to do back then too, because that was before most theaters had reserved seating. Now everybody, if you wait to the last minute now because you assume tickets for Doomsday will be available for at least a month or maybe a month and a half before the movie actually rolls out, that if all of a sudden you decide at the last second to move it up a week, that's gonna be chaos because everybody who bought tickets is gonna have to dump their tickets and come back and buy new tickets because they're gonna have to pick out their seats all over again. So I would suspect they will move. I think that would be the smartest plan for them. To move up anyway, and then you're still going to get repeat business over the holiday weekend anyway. But it's more important for Marvel to have that opening weekend than it is for Dune.
The only movie, or the next movie to come out that's from one of our lists would be what, Michael, later this month?
Yeah, that's an April release.
Okay. Are you going to go see that?
Probably not.
I know you don't have any really interest in that, you said.
Yeah, I doubt it, especially with my movie going schedule in flux right now. Hopefully we'll go back to Thursday nights. That's what we're hoping. But at the moment, it's not. But it would probably only be Friday, if not. So it's not the end of the world. I just prefer seeing stuff the night it comes out. But no, I doubt it. That really doesn't have an appeal to me. I got to be honest with you. There are very few biopics that it has to be a subject that I like. I don't like. I am not going to sit and watch a biopic just to watch a biopic. I know some people like those genres, and that's cool. And they're more than that. It's like books. It's like some people just really like reading biographies or autobiographies. People really like that in general. It's not necessarily who it's about is as important as the fact that, oh, I like getting this view into this person's mind from their, their own worldview and describing things and why they made these decisions, or somebody who you really trust as a historian looking back at these events and doing a biography. But I can just like, so again, it has to interest me what the subject matter is. I'm not as disinterested. Again, backhanded compliment. I probably would be more interested in the Michael Jackson pick than I certainly would be in the Bruce Springsteen pick we got, or even, your Bohemian Rhapsody. Even the Elton John one was hard. I mean, and I like Elton John. Even that was something that it was a little bit of a struggle for me to get through. And I read his book too, so I shouldn't have been. But
yeah, I haven't seen the Bruce Springsteen one or heard much about it. The one that I've been meaning to watch is, I think it was called Moon Age. I think it was about David Bowie.
Yeah,
I've been meaning, that's been on my list for a while, but I just haven't touched it yet.
Moon Age Daydream, I believe.
Yeah, something like that.
2022. Yeah, well, I mean, it looks like it's going to do well based on tracking. It looks like it's going to do very, very well. And so I think that's cool. Every time we get something that does well, it's certainly good for the exhibition industry, whether it's, Project Hail Mary, which continues to plug along, or Super
Mario. I've been meaning to see that again. Have you seen it a second time or not?
No, I would consider it, especially if my movie going schedule goes completely up in the air. Maybe that's something I would consider even seeing again on my own, seeing Project Hail Mary again. But I'm still only like about 40 pages into the book. I haven't had a chance to make any progress yet. Been dealing with a sick cat, and even by the time I get into bed, I'm usually ready to crap out. So even if my plan, even if I bring the book into bed with me, as opposed to just trying to read something on the Kindle, lately I've just been just ready to go to bed and not even opening it. But I would like to see it again. The good news is, again, just got to stop saying again. The episode, the password is again that it will be on. It's a matter of time before it'll be on Prime, because it's an Amazon MGM movie. So at some point it'll be free on Prime. The question is how long after they make people pay for it. I'm not as familiar with Prime's normal pattern, because I've only really been watching a lot of Prime over the last 3 months or so, ever since I had my own Prime now, since they did away with the family thing and you had to buy your own, that I've been spending a little bit more time watching movies on Prime. So I will at least watch it again when it comes on there, but I would like to see it again in the theater, considering there's not a lot out there. Oh, speaking in a somewhat unrelated note, but it made me think, since I was thinking of Prime, that just like all the Saw movies are on Netflix, all the Alien movies happen to be on HBO Max currently, including Romulus, all of them, AVP, both of them. What's interesting is, and I thought I saw this, but I couldn't find it when I did the search. So maybe it's there and it's buried, but I didn't see the director's cut of Alien. But almost all the other extended versions are on for all. And it's there. There's, and most of these, I shouldn't say most. Many of these I have or have seen, because I have the Blu-ray box set of Alien, of the first four movies. So I think that includes the different versions, the extended versions. But they also have an extended version of the original AVP, the Sanaa Lathan one. And I had never watched that before. I think most of the extra footage, most of these things are like 8 or 9 minutes longer. And most of the AVP one is at the beginning, because you actually see a scene that takes place in 1904 in that whaling village that the whole entrance to the pyramid happens to be over, that you actually see what happened in 1904 to the whaling, to the whaling community, the whaling village. But all those are available to watch, including, like I said, the extended versions of both AVPs. They have Romulus on, of course, Prometheus and Covenant are still on. And for some reason, in my adventures in streaming, I love the fact that HBO Max, I love their algorithms, just because of the fact that they have this massive hard-on for Covenant, which I don't quite understand. And again, Covenant's fine. I don't mind. I can watch Covenant anytime. It doesn't bother me. But almost any alien movie I've put on, the next movie they started playing next randomly was Covenant. I started the original. You think they'd go to Aliens? No, they went to Covenant. I put Romulus on. They went to Covenant. And they go to Covenant often. They did go to Prometheus once. I think they went to Prometheus once. And they did. And I give them credit a lot when they did follow AVP with AVP Requiem. At least they did that one logically. But their algorithms just make me laugh sometimes, because I just don't understand why they just can't follow some normal. It's like every time, I mean, it's like watching them jump around from John Wick movies instead of playing them in order. Regardless, like I put Ballerina on. And then, of course, Ballerina is going to end. You know they're going to play another John Wick movie. And sometimes they'll start with the first movie. But then they'll jump to, like, part three, Parabellum. It's like, what about part two? Why don't you go in order at some point instead of just hop, skipping, and jumping? I don't really understand it. but nonetheless.
No, I've been meaning to rewatch Alien for a while. Because I have Alien, the theatrical version. I didn't get the director's cut. And I have Aliens, but I'm just waiting for a time I can watch it during the day, because I'm a little bitch.
Of all of them, you'd be that way, or just the first one because of the claustrophobic aspect of it?
No, it's just I've never liked horror movies or not necessarily. Would you consider Alien a horror movie? I guess the first one for sure.
Some people,
right?
Yeah, I think some people.
Yeah.
The first one would be more the closest one to being more horror. To me, it's still science fiction, but it does walk the line. But I would say the first one is probably the most horror.
Yeah, I don't. This is gonna sound like I'm trying to defend my masculinity or some shit, but like, it's not that it like scares me so much as because it makes me jumpy. I still feel anxious and jumpy after watching the film, and I don't like going to bed like that. So that's why I would watch it like during the day. I don't like, if I watch a movie, typically speaking, at home, it's usually in the evening before bed. I just don't like feeling anxious and jumpy right before I go to bed. The only time I've ever felt like as an adult legitimately, I guess, scared after watching a scary movie would be the first Paranormal Activity. Just because you never see anything. It's just a bunch of like random cabinets opening or sounds happening in the house and shit, which happens to all of us on a daily basis, right? So like you get home and you're all of a sudden like you're by yourself, and you're all of a sudden, well, I guess with you with cats, it's like, well, one of the cats must have got into shit. But like for me, I'm just like, what the fuck was that? it makes me jumpy. I don't like that feeling.
I get it. But yeah, so if you're a John Wick fan, or if you're an Alien fan, that all, since all those movies are on HBO Max, go to town. But Alien, I thought Alien they just added in. So I thought that, I mean, some of them have been around. I've been on the platform for a while, like Covenant and Prometheus, I think, have been back on for a long time. But Romulus is brand new. They just added Romulus in. So I think that's, yeah. So it's cool. Again, this is where if they would just give us the ability to build a damn playlist, so you could just put them together, watch them, can watch them in any order that you want to watch them in too. I mean, I will give them a slight pass with the algorithm, a slight pass for why they skip over maybe Prometheus a little bit, because technically it's the only Alien movie that doesn't have Alien in the title. They really should Raiders of the Lost Ark that movie and name it Alien Prometheus now, like they made the first movie Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark, technically, the way it's packaged now, so it belongs and fits in title-wise with all the other Indiana Jones movies. They really should do that with Prometheus, just because all the other Alien movies have Alien in the title. Alien, Aliens, Alien 3, Alien Resurrection, Alien vs. Predator, Alien Romulus, Alien Covenant. Not in that order, because I got the last two out of order. But the point is, Prometheus is the only one that doesn't literally have Alien in the title, though it is an Alien movie. It's less of an Alien movie, technically, I suppose, than the others, but still. But the good news is you obviously still can watch them in the order you want, and if you want to watch the extended version of Aliens, which has some value, getting to see the stuff on what LV-426, what Newt's family and village or community was like before they sent them to go find the ship and look for the eggs and things of that nature. But it's they're all worth. I think it's cool to have the option not only of watching them, but being able to watch like the extended version, because that sometimes adds some interesting insights about what could have been in the movie. And sometimes you'll understand why it was cut out, and other times it's like, well, it would have made more sense to keep it in retrospect.
Oh, sorry, I was scrolling through what movies I had just so I could figure out if I still owned Alien and Aliens, which I do. I just saw, because I was sorting it alphabetically. Did you hear about, like, it was like November or something, James Cameron and I think, what's his name, Rodriguez, Robert Rodriguez apparently have a blood oath to do a sequel to Alita.
Oh, Battle Angel, yeah.
Well, yeah.
That's not surprising, because of the fact that we know Cameron wants to do that.
Yeah.
However, the interesting thing is, probably he would have done that, because one of the stories that's going around today, the fact that I guess Disney and Cameron are not on the same page about Avatar 4 and 5. That Cameron definitely wants to make them, but Disney wants him to make them. They want him to make them cheaper if he's going to make them. So because of that, there's a chance that maybe Cameron, who if Fire and Ash had been more successful, there was some talk that some people believed, I think, in that based on inside gossip, that he might have taken a movie off to do something else in between before coming back to finish 4 and 5. But because of the fact that Fire and Ash didn't do as well as the others, and because of what's going on with the finances and stuff, that he might want to do whatever agreement they come to do 4 and 5 next and get them out of the way. Instead of allowing the plug to potentially, I guess, be pulled or increase whatever odds there are that it might not happen, finishing his vision by letting it sit, that he gets the chance to, whatever agreement they come up with to just go do it. Just make the movie shorter. Just make them a little shorter. You'd save a lot of money just there if you didn't make every movie over 3 hours.
So. That's true. All right. Well, if people want to reach out to us about any of the topics we discussed tonight, what do they do?
Lanterncast@gmail.com. The website is lanterncast.com. You can follow us on Blue Sky, Twitter, like us on Facebook, #GLcast. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean. Wherever you listen to us on, please leave us a positive review. Last but not least, like I said, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail or a text, 708-LANTERN, and let us know what you think. Lanterncast Vids. And if you're interested, that's our YouTube. And if you're interested in our Discord, email us and we'll send you the info.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.